It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. The easiest and the oldest exercise in the world has deep roots in our DNA. Walking. We've been doing it for at least 3 million years. It makes us healthier, happier, smarter, more relaxed, more resilient, even longer lived.
Walking made us human, really. It's so much in our DNA. And in the last 20 years, really, we've just walked less and less and less.
It is incredibly good for you. There was a meta study that was done that showed that just a 20-minute walk a day can add 3 to 5 years to your life.
Wow.
But even with the best of intentions, sometimes we all need a little push to get out the door. Stay tuned for some inspiration. This hour, walk with me. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. Walking is something you can do every day. Something so simple, it's easy to take for granted.
About 8 years ago, I was at London Book Fair, and I was walking home carrying lots and lots of books from the book fair. Something started to happen in my head. It was very strange. I just started to feel very dizzy, and some part of my vision was doing very strange things. I couldn't recognise any of the landmarks, and I didn't know where I was, and I was feeling very frightened. I couldn't find my house on my own street. I was walking in and out of all the houses of my neighbours, and I kept getting to the front door and thinking, this isn't my door. Where am I? Why can't I find my house? By this stage, I was feeling very, very faint. And then the next thing I knew, I was in an ambulance. I had collapsed fairly close to my house. One of my neighbours found me lying on the pavement. I spent about 8 days in intensive care because I'd cracked my skull. I still couldn't move because the crack on my head had affected my vestibular system, my system of balance. Whenever I moved, I felt as though I was on a rocking ship, that I was very drunk at the same time, so everything just swayed round and round and round. So while I was lying there very, very still on all of these drips and wires, I couldn't do anything except watch what was happening around me. There are all these people walking, and they don't realise how lucky they are. And of course, I then realised that I had not realised how lucky I was. I had just taken that ability to move my legs, taken it completely for granted. Why have I just been sitting around for years, just, you know, as we do, sitting on laptops and sitting at desks and just sitting. And the other thing was, in the past, I'd always hated my legs. I hated the way they looked. And as I lay in this hospital bed, I just had this epiphany where I thought, right, this is it. From now on, I'm just walking.
Annabelle Abbs kept the promise she made to herself in the hospital. When she got out, she made a real effort to walk every day, and it turned out to be addictive. She started walking longer and farther and faster, walking for days, sometimes weeks. And then she started to wonder, who else walked like her? She wrote about what she discovered in a book called Windswept.
I like to do very long distances. I quite like some of the more hardcore elements. I quite like to carry a backpack. I like to walk quite quickly. It just becomes more and more meditative, really. And you move into a slightly different state of consciousness. And you don't want it to stop. You just want to keep going and going. So I suppose my style is sort of fast and...
Fast and intense.
Fast and intense.
You like to push yourself. That's great. You wound up getting really interested in the history of women walkers, and you discovered all these stories, forgotten stories, of women who had walked huge, epic distances. How did you even begin discovering them?
Well, I was reading lots and lots of books about walking, and they were all by men, or by men about men, or even sometimes by women, but about men. And I thought, this is very strange, because, you know, if walking had such a profound effect on me and my state of mind, then surely it must have done that for women in the past. So, you know, where are they? So I just started literally scouring libraries. I just started digging through very old accounts of my time in the Alps, 1865, or my trip over the Pyrenees, yeah, 1830, written by women. And they were never, ever acknowledged by that canon of male walkers. So they just sort of got more and more lost.
And what's fascinating, I think, is that if you don't know that there has been this history of women who have walked fast distances, it constrains your sense of your own possibilities.
Absolutely. It's very empowering. Once you know that women have not only done these routes, but they did them with no mobile phone, no GPS. They didn't have bras. They didn't have waterproof trousers. They didn't have rehydratable, you know, meals you can eat straight from a bag. They didn't have lightweight backpacks. They didn't have any of these things. And yet they were there walking 20 or 30 miles a day, often day after day after day. And the other interesting thing was that there were also, I did discover, there were also a lot of women who were quite well known. But again, if you look at someone like Georgia O'Keeffe or Simone de Beauvoir, everybody knows who they are, and they know O'Keeffe for her paintings, and they know Simone de Beauvoir for her writings, but they don't know either woman for these incredible long-distance walks that they did.
Give me a sense of the range of women whose stories you began collecting, and do you have favourites?
One of them is a woman called Catherine Trevelyan, and she walked right across Canada when she was 23 from, you know, literally from one side of Canada to the other on her own.
Wow.
With a tent on her back and a gun. Her father made her take a revolver. And she would pitch her tent up in, you know, Canadian forests. And she wrote about it all sort of later on in this account, which again is completely forgotten.
Wow. And this is what, 100 years ago?
Well, she did that in 1933.
Okay.
So almost 100 years ago.
Alone.
Alone, yeah. At 23. She was a favourite of mine. I do love Simone de Beauvoir because of the way in which she walks. You know, she's a sort of military walker. She's clocking up these miles and she walks really fast, trying to see whether she could go further or higher or faster in a way that we take for granted now. But women back in the 1920s and 30s just didn't do that.
Yeah, I wanted to focus a bit on Simone de Beauvoir because we think of her as this creature of Paris cafes. We imagine her smoking cigarettes with Jean-Paul Sartre, wearing a turban, the chic feminist philosopher, but not a backpacker.
Well, she discovered walking when she got her first job as a teacher, a philosophy teacher in the south of France. And it was the first time she'd left Paris, the first time she'd left home. Mm. And she started by pushing herself with the walking, and then she would start taking on trails where she was having to clamber and literally climb over rocks. She has a lot of accidents where she sort of falls into ravines, and quite often she thinks she's about to die.
Really?
Yeah.
Was she really endangered?
Well, there was one particular incident where she fell into a ravine and she couldn't get back out. She lay there for hours screaming and calling for help, and no one came. But then she does somehow manage to climb out eventually.
Oh.
You know, because also she's going to places that nobody walks. So it's not your usual Sunday afternoon trail. There's no one else there. And you know, she travels with a water bottle full of red wine. I love that.
That's very French. What would be a normal walk for Simone de Beauvoir?
Oh, she would do 25 to 30 miles a day. And sometimes she would sleep rough. So she talks about sleeping on benches, sleeping in barns, sleeping out in fields. She plots these routes herself. She's not following trails. She's plotting the routes with army maps that she gets hold of. She'll spend whole evenings just working out her route and working out which way she's going to go.
This is obsessive.
Yeah.
Driven.
And she uses that very word.
So what was driving her?
She looks back later from sort of midlife and she says, that was my crazy, obsessive, fanatical walking.
Hmm. What was going on?
I suppose the great thing about walking is that you are not only walking away from something physically and literally, but you're also walking towards something. And I think she was walking away from Jean-Paul Sartre and his infidelities, because the time of her huge obsessive walking is absolutely the time that he is saying we must have an open relationship, and he is having lots and lots of affairs. And she really, really loves him. And she doesn't really want to have this open relationship, but she knows it to be a true existentialist. She has to have this very open mind. So the walking is partly her walking away from him, and she's partly testing her ability to be on her own. She takes a lot of risks. She often hitches rides to and from the start points of her walks, and she has a lot of really lucky escapes from men who sometimes have knives and often want her to sleep with them or to roll with them in a ditch. They were assaulting her. And she would jump out of moving cars. And
wow.
And every time she escaped from one of these encounters, she was quite extraordinary. She would say, right, that's it. You know, I'm invincible. I'm even more invincible.
Wasn't she at one point, some truck driver beat her up and dumped her body in a ravine?
Yeah, absolutely. She was like, I've survived that, so I can survive again.
That seems like, I don't know what, like some kind of reveling in physical strength, as though it's a marker, a signpost of something else, some other kind of strength that she wants.
Yeah, the freedom that she finds with this sort of new body of hers, she starts discovering her body can do all these things. She also starts to find that freedom to think, to find her own voice. And it's no coincidence, really, that the first thing she really writes at the end of all this walking is The Second Sex. Definitely, her philosophy of feminism is shaped by this confidence that she finds walking.
The women you profile in this book are some of the most creative in history. I mean, Georgia O'Keeffe, a painter, Gwen Johns, another painter, Nan Shepherd, Simone de Beauvoir. Do you think there's a connection between walking and creativity?
Yeah, I do. Also, some of it, I think, is very basic biology. When you're walking outdoors, you have got this sort of oxygen coming into your lungs, and your brain is just being reoxygenated the whole time. And the brain works much better if it's got oxygen. Every part of your body is working, but at a very low level. So it's not like running. Your brain is able to go another place. You're not having to think at all. Walking really lends itself to a more mindful state that I don't think you could do with any other form of physical movement.
It's interesting. The women you profiled all felt so compelled to walk, but the walking itself seemed to change them. And today we know there are reasons why walking can change you.
Yeah. One of the things that I really love, and it's very, very simple, is this idea of panoramic vision. So if you think of your eyes always on your laptop, on your phone, hour after hour, your eyes are really like two fists. They're focusing hard. All the muscles are clenched without you really realizing it, because it's the norm, isn't it? But what happens when you move outside and you extend your gaze, say, up to the sky or even to the trees or, you know, to the stars if it's at night or whatever, your eyes completely change and you switch into this panoramic vision and your stress levels completely fall. It's such a simple thing. But I think the thing we have to remember is that our ancestors have been walking for millennia. In fact, walking made us human, really. It was walking that enabled us to move on from being an ape or a primate and become a human being, a Homo sapiens. So it's partly that it's so much in our DNA. And in the last, 20 years, really, we've just walked less and less and less.
Yeah.
The last two decades, we've walked less than ever.
Annabelle Abbs has written two books about walking. Windswept, Walking the Paths of Trailblazing Women, and under the name Annabelle Streets, 52 Ways to Walk. Coming up, we'll take a trip back in time to figure out how our ancient ancestors learned to walk.
The first time I went to the rainforest to study chimpanzees, a chimpanzee climbed a tree right in front of me. It was able to press its foot. The top of its foot was flexible enough to touch the front of its shin bone. Think about that for a second, that you can pull the top of your foot against your shin and then twist the foot almost like you can your hand. The first motion would have snapped my Achilles tendon. The second motion would have sprained my ankle terribly. And yet, here's this chimpanzee climbing a tree right in front of me with the same general bones that I have, the same 26 bones in its foot that I have, and yet it's able to perform a motion that I can't. I was fascinated, and I needed to know, how is it able to do that?
I would so love to be able to climb trees like a chimpanzee, but our feet were made for walking. Paleoanthropologist Jerry DeSilva explains how and why after this. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Six million years ago, give or take, the first early humans stood upright and started walking. The world has never been the same, but how and why we traded scampering around in trees for walking on two legs is still a mystery. So Steve Paulson tracked down a guy who is reinterpreting the fossil record and has some new theories about how humans learned to walk.
My name is Jeremy DeSilva. I'm a paleoanthropologist at Dartmouth College. I'm interested in the very beginnings of the human lineage and what set us off on our path. And what we can tell from studying these fossils is that bipedalism, moving on two legs, is the most ancient human adaptation. It's what happened first. It set the stage for all of the things that happened later, from our language and our dietary flexibility to our reliance on technology and tools, the way we give birth and we raise our children. All of these things really have their roots in how we move. Here, I'll show you.
Okay.
So this fossil is from a creature, Sahelanthropus, that lived between 6 and 7 million years ago.
So that's right around the time that our branch of evolution diverged from the ancestors of chimps, right?
Exactly, which is why this is such an exciting fossil. It's a magnificent skull. Now, if we flip the skull over and look at the hole at the very bottom, this is where your spinal cord exits the brain through your neck. And it's positioned at the very bottom of the skull, which is different from what we'd see in something moving on all fours. And so this is tantalizing evidence. And not surprisingly, it's really controversial.
And one of the reasons why it's so important from an evolutionary perspective to try to figure out when we branched off from chimpanzees is that chimps and gorillas are not actually bipedal. They don't walk like we do.
No, they don't. They don't. They can, right? They can get up on two legs, but it's not a very efficient form of locomotion for them. Their knees are bent. They can't support their bodies on a single leg, so they fall over and they wobble.
And they knuckle walk. Usually when they're getting around, they're kind of on all fours, but the knuckles on the front arms are down on the ground.
That's exactly right. And one of the hypotheses for years and years and years, and this is something that your listeners are probably familiar with, they've seen it on T-shirts and bumper stickers and coffee cups, is that the common ancestor we shared with chimpanzees would have been a knuckle walker, and that bipedalism evolved from something that was moving on its knuckles.
Right.
Now, we can test this idea by looking at fossils that are from that time period, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 million years ago. We don't have many, but what fossils we do have are not from knuckle walkers. They're from these apes that were living, many of them living in southern Europe, living in France and Italy and Spain,
really?
Greece, yeah. Turkey, yeah. Germany. The forests of Africa at this time period had spread north and hugged what is today the Mediterranean. And apes love forests. They love trees that are producing fruit. But what we're finding are these apes that tend to be somewhat upright in the trees, moving on the tops of branches, holding on to branches above them, and moving bipedally, moving on two legs in the trees.
Can I just say that sounds really counterintuitive to be standing upright in trees?
Yep.
It seems like there'd be a better way to live in trees than to be standing on two legs.
Yeah, it certainly does. And for a long time, it was thought that once bipedalism evolved, once we started walking around on two legs, that everyone is sort of doing it in the same kind of way. But there was a discovery a couple of years ago in South Africa of what's called Australopithecus sediba. So I'll take you over to Australopithecus sediba.
Yeah.
This is a composite skeleton discovered in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And we can tell from her bones that she moved on two legs. But in each of those places, whether it's the hip or the lower back or the knee or the ankle, her bones were strange. They didn't quite look like they should.
Mm-hmm.
And what do I mean by that? What should they look like? Well, she's what we call an Australopithecus. And we already had a skeleton of an Australopithecus, the very famous Lucy.
Right, right.
But they looked so different from one another.
Hmm.
And what we ended up concluding was that this is evidence that they actually walked differently. And so even with upright walking, there were these different experiments going on.
Can you describe that then? Like, if we were looking at them each walk, what would be different about that?
Yeah, so with Lucy, not only do we have her skeleton, but we have bones of lots of other individuals that were found near her.
Mm-hmm.
And her species even left us footprints.
Oh, wow.
In Tanzania, okay. These extraordinary footprints,
right,
known as the Laetoli footprints. And so from the footprints and from the skeletons, we can infer that their gait, how they walked, was a lot like ours.
Mm-hmm.
They landed with a heel strike. They transferred a lot of their weight to their big toe like we do. They had a slightly flatter foot than we do, so they couldn't quite push off as we do today. But if you could see Lucy at a distance, just walking along, you wouldn't really notice a difference.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah, she would walk a lot like us.
Huh.
She wasn't hunched over.
Okay.
She wasn't bent hip, bent knee. She didn't walk like an upright chimpanzee. She walked a lot like us.
And this was what, like 3.2 million years
ago?
Exactly,
exactly. Yeah. So by 3 million years ago, you have a very human-like gait that had evolved in Australopithecus, what we call Australopithecus afarensis, Lucy and her kind.
One of the fascinating things that I was reading when I was reading your book was you said that if you could magically go back in time to any period, you'd go back to the time of Lucy.
I would.
Why?
Lucy is an icon of our science. Everyone's heard of Lucy.
Right.
Still. And yet, we still have many questions about her. We still don't entirely know how her species is related to ours.
Mm-hmm.
If it's an extinct side branch, or if it's a direct ancestor. We still have questions about diet. We still have questions about the everyday life of our extinct ancestors.
So describe as much as you can what Lucy looked like and what her life was like. She was like little, wasn't she? Like 3.5 feet tall or something?
That's right. So she was tiny, tiny, tiny. And yet we know she was a full-grown adult.
3.5 to 4 feet tall, they would be sitting ducks for the big carnivores out there, I would think.
And I'll show you one of those carnivores.
Okay.
This is called a Homotherium. This is one of these large cats we find fossils of.
I mean, this looks like, I don't know, a tiger or a lion, some leopard maybe.
I don't know.
Huge incisors, my God.
That's right. And bigger than a modern lion. Huh. Not only did you have these large cats, but you had enormous hyenas living in the same environment.
So we were the hunted, not the hunters.
That's exactly right. And a lot of folks think that the origins of our lineage, this goes back to Darwin's time, mm-hmm. But then was really celebrated and popularized in the 1950s and 1960s. This idea that we only survived because we were wielding weapons and bipedalism happened because we could free the hands for tools and weaponry, and that we were a violent, bloodthirsty ape. And instead, right, we were the hunted. We weren't the hunters.
So I'm still trying to figure out how we survived.
Okay, and I'm going to make it even worse on you. So not only are we slow on the landscape, but we are easily injured. Huh. So now you're moving on two legs. And what if you break one of those legs? If you're moving on all four and you break one of those legs, well, you still have three. You still can get away. What if you break a leg, right?
Yeah.
And we have fossil evidence that that happened. So here is a femur from Kenya, and it was discovered in the 1970s. Not only is this a fractured femur, it's a healed fractured femur. So this individual broke their leg and then survived.
Survived.
Wow. Survived. So now I think the pieces are beginning to come together.
So it must have been cared for.
Exactly. Exactly. So how did a slow biped surrounded by predators on a dangerous landscape, how did we survive? How did our ancestors survive? They looked out for each other. Hmm. They took care of each other. When somebody was injured, they didn't leave them for dead. They brought them to a tree where they could heal, and they probably brought them food and kept watch over them. Look, one of the things that we can and should celebrate about being human is our cooperative nature and our compassion for one another. You know, we can be awful to each other. We all know that. We see plenty of news to know that we can be awful to each other. But we often overlook how good we can be to each other as well.
And one thing that you mentioned sort of in passing is that these were slow, these creatures. And walking on two legs has some serious disadvantages. Like, you cannot outrun a lion or a cheetah. You're toast if you get into a foot race there.
That's right.
Again, an argument for why walking upright, bipedalism, doesn't seem like such a great idea.
No. We don't even have to go back in time to talk about how slow we are. The fastest human being on the planet, the fastest human who's ever existed as far as we know, Usain Bolt, mm-hmm. the fastest he ever ran in his 100-meter world record-setting race was 28 miles an hour. That's half the speed of a galloping zebra or antelope. It's half the speed of a leopard or a lion.
And of course, Usain Bolt can only do that for 10 seconds.
That's exactly right. Exactly. So one of the other things that we infer is a shift in activity patterns in our early ancestors. So when do lions and leopards go out to hunt? Well, it's usually dawn and dusk. So were Australopithecines out there collecting their food at dawn and dusk? I don't think so. Hmm. I think that's exactly when they were up in their trees making a nest for the night. It was only in the heat of the day that they would be able to come down safely in order to collect food. The heat of the day, lions and leopards, they're asleep. They're underneath trees. They're trying to get shade. Whereas that's exactly when humans today are their most active. And I think that's exactly when our ancestors probably were active as well. But they couldn't be picky out there in their landscape. So they have to gather up and eat whatever they can. And what we can tell from Lucy and her kind by studying the isotopes of their teeth is that right around that time, 3.5 million years ago, they went from eating forest foods, very fruit-heavy diet, to eating everything. And that's exactly what we see in humans today. We collectively eat everything, right? If it has DNA in it, we've tried it as a species. Again, I think it goes back to being bipedal, being vulnerable on a dangerous landscape, and not being able to afford to be a picky eater.
Can I just say this is a story about our very humble origins? Our ancestors, Lucy and her kind, were not kings of the savannah, anything but.
Absolutely. One of the things that has struck me as I study these fossils that are 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 million years old of our ancestors in Eastern and South Africa, I am amazed that they survived. And of course, many of them went extinct. But enough of them survived that here we are. And so the resilience, the ingenuity, the creativity, the, you know, the ability of these ancestors of ours to survive despite all of the odds stacked against them is pretty remarkable. It makes me want to sort of celebrate them, you know, beyond just the, you know, the shapes of the bones. They were extraordinary.
Now, there is a kind of bird that is an interesting counterexample to the bipedalism of humans, and that's the ostrich, or the emu, who, on two legs, can run very fast. Why are they so much better at running than we are?
A couple of reasons. So their legs are all bone and tendon. All the muscles are up in the body of the animal. And what that helps them do, it puts the weight farther away from the thing that's moving, and it allows their legs to go with much more frequency, to go faster, 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 faster. And so ostriches can run 45 miles an hour or so. They also, you know, if you look at a human foot, a human foot has 26 individual bones in it.
26? That's a lot.
26 individual bones. And you have 2 feet, right? Mm-hmm. So you have 52 foot bones. And that means a quarter of your skeleton is made of foot bones.
Wait, that's crazy.
Right? Tons and tons and tons of foot bones. Okay. So why is that? Well, we descend from apes. We are primates. And primates live in trees. And you need in trees to have a mobile foot. So think about an orangutan's foot or a chimpanzee's foot. They can use their foot in the same way that I use my hand. They can grab onto things. Well, the bones that we have in our foot, those are the exact same 26 bones that a chimpanzee has. They're just tweaked a little bit. And that converts our foot from a grasping organ, like a chimp has, into one that can push off the ground. It can act as more of a lever. But we still have those 26 individual bones, and they still, you know, want to move relative to each other. And well, what results? Well, you get plantar fasciitis, or you get, you know, ankle sprains.
You're saying
you
this is actually a badly designed foot.
Oh, it's a disaster. Yeah. But, I mean, look, evolution works with what it has, with whatever pre-existing form it has, and it tweaks and it tinkers and it modifies. And it doesn't create perfection. It creates just good enough to survive.
So by contrast, what about an ostrich foot?
Ah, so the ostrich foot, again, think about an ostrich lineage. It doesn't come from an ape or a primate. It is descended from bipedal dinosaurs. An ostrich foot, what has happened is that many of the bones of their ancestors' feet have fused together into a single rigid column called a tarsometatarsus. They've reduced the number of digits. So they only have 8 bones in their feet, so less capacity for motion. And instead, their foot looks a lot like the Paralympic prosthetic blade that athletes will use, that single rigid structure that can hit the ground, store elastic energy, and then push off the ground and propel them into their next step.
Which raises some fascinating questions. I mean, one is, might we evolve if we survive for millions more years to have a better foot? Could some of those 26 bones fused together so that we'd have more of an ostrich foot? And I guess the other question is, just given technology, would we be better off if there was some intervention to make a better human foot?
Sure, I can absolutely imagine that there could be technology that could improve the anatomy of the human foot.
So what would your ideal human foot look like?
Oh, it'd be an ostrich foot. Oh, I totally have an ostrich foot. And leg, right? So, you run 45 miles an hour with that kind of setup. But I don't think, if we could go a million years in the future, I don't think we'd have a dramatically different kind of foot. And one of the reasons for that is because we solve some of these problems that we have. We solve them culturally. Mm-hmm. That if somebody has foot problems, we bring them to the doctor. We take care of them. We wrap them up in a bandage. We give them ice to control swelling and ibuprofen. And we are a biocultural animal. Ostriches aren't.
Yeah. Do you think of humans as being essentially a walking species? And I'm partly asking that because it's considered very good for our health to walk.
It is. It is incredibly good for you. Physiologically, when your muscles contract, they release something called myokines into the bloodstream. And there are many different kinds of them. There are over 100 different myokines that have been identified. They target different tissues of the body, including the brain. And these myokines have been associated with general cardiovascular health, reduction in cancer risk, reduction in diabetes risk, reduction in early onset dementia. I mean, there are all of these things that are, these general health benefits. There was a meta study that was done that showed that just a 20-minute walk a day can add 3 to 5 years to your life.
Wow.
Just going for a walk.
Yeah.
So you don't have to do anything crazy, Yeah. Just go for a walk.
Yeah.
That's Jerry DeSilva, a paleoanthropologist at Dartmouth College and the author of First Steps, How Upright Walking Made Us Human. And he was talking with Steve Paulson. Coming up, walking isn't just good for you. It's also good for the planet.
Well, first of all, what I've heard is two oil tankers crashed, and I go down there and see all this oil, I'm just sick,
In 1971, I saw an oil spill in San Francisco Bay.
The ducks, we clean their eyes off, clean their nostrils, then clean their mouth area so they don't swallow anything.
And I decided to do something about the oil that washed up on the beach besides clean it. I gave up riding in cars.
Moving in silent desperation. Say, who is this walking man?
And that was a big shock for a lot of people in this little community.
Walking man.
And we argued about whether one person could make a difference. And on my 27th birthday, I decided I was going to take a break from speaking because I was arguing all the time. So for one day, I decided I wasn't going to speak. And that day lasted 17 years. And the walking lasted 22 years.
The planet walker, John Francis, tells his story next. Right here on To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. And PRX.
Thank you.
One of the most inspiring walkers I've ever met is John Francis. A lot of people know him as the Planet Walker. His story begins in 1971 with the famous oil spill in the San Francisco Bay. John was living nearby in a small town called Inverness on the Point Reyes coast, and he decided he could not stand contributing to fossil fuel consumption anymore, so he stopped riding in cars. And then he went a step further and stopped talking. And this lasted for nearly 20 years, during which time he walked all over the country and somehow also earned a PhD in environmental studies. Steve and I met John a few years ago at the Geography of Hope conference in Point Reyes, California, where it all began.
On this Earth Day, millions of Americans in the communities which dot this map have taken the first step to survival.
I was actually walking first, and that's when people wanted to argue with me. And I argued, you know, that one person could make a difference, I'm sure. But I wasn't sure. And so when people came to argue with me about what I was doing, instead, I listened. You know, in this little village, of course, everyone knew when I was walking, and we knew what everyone was doing in this little village. Well, you know, John just stopped riding in cars because of the oil spill, and now he stopped talking because he's decided that it's better to listen. That got around. Hey, John Francis will listen to you. Let's go talk to him. The thing about this large black man walking with not saying anything is that I carried a banjo. And so I played music all the time. I played music walking up and down the road until where people start to recognize, they could hear me coming, and they said, oh, here comes John. If you're moving at that pace, there are people driving back and forth all the time, and they're talking about that guy who's walking, and they go, oh yeah, that guy. Well, you know about him, don't you? Yeah, he's the guy from Inverness, and he doesn't ride in cars. He just walks. He doesn't talk. He doesn't talk. Come on, let's go over and try and get him to talk. And so they pull over and try to get me to say something, or I play the banjo, and they drive off and say, that guy didn't talk. He really doesn't talk. They tell the next people in the next town. And so I think your reputation precedes you moving at a human pace like that. When I started actually getting from my leaving my community, I thought of it as a sacred journey. And here I was more in touch with Native people and First Nation thinking about journeying from one place to another. So my first journey was from Inverness to the Siskiyou Mountains in Oregon and the Kalmiopsis Wilderness. And I have to say, not speaking and walking so much put me in an altered state. Things became alive and things became really different for me that I would never have understood hadn't I embarked on this journey. When I say spiritual, it's almost like to say spiritual and something that's invisible, but you know it's there. It's like the wind. You know, the wind is invisible, but you know it's there. I felt the wind a lot. I had some experiences with people, actually only one experience with an off-duty deputy sheriff. They pointed a gun to my head. And it was like, this is Mr. Death. This is Mr. Death. And I was like thinking, so this is the time, and I didn't do my painting for the day. Because I painted every day a watercolor. And so when they said something about, we don't like, and they didn't use a particularly nice word, these two off-duty sheriffs, deputy sheriffs, and they pointed a gun to my 44 caliber. I could look down there. I remember Dirty Harry. And I said, oh, yeah, that's what that is. I just mentioned it to my fingers that I was walking south. I said, well, you get going. And I could see myself in the back of their pickup truck, you know, being put somewhere. And that didn't happen. I turned around and they were gone. So I sat right down and took out my watercolors and started painting. Because I wanted to get my watercolor done before Mr. Death came around again. Well, I got down to the Russian River, and I camped at the Russian River. Then I got scared. I said, oh, my God. Hey, this is, you know, I could die doing this. I could die. But then I said to myself, I listened to the call of a loon. And, you know, these loons that woo woo woo. That was healing to me. In the morning, I got up and I said, well, you know, I could hitchhike or get in a car or any of those things, but I'm going to keep walking because death's going to find me soon enough. So I'm just going to keep walking. And that's what I did. I just kept walking.
Why did you start talking again?
Well, that's a really good question, and I'm glad you asked that. Because after walking all across the United States and listening to so many people, people that had flags that were Confederate flags, that had brought me into their homes to stay and took care of me, after I got to the other side of the United States, I realized that environment was about human-made ugliness, pollution. It was about loss of species and habitat and climate change, all those things environment was about. But the most important thing was it was about people and how we treated each other. And so I had something to say. And so on the 20th anniversary of Earth Day, I chose that day to remind myself that I was going to speak for the environment.
20 years ago, students in this country led the fight to stop a war, the war in Vietnam. Well, today we must stop an even bigger war. We must stop the war against the Earth. Will you help? Will you say it? Say, stop the war!
Did your life go back to the way it had been before? Had it changed sort of irrevocably because of all these years of doing what you did?
No. It's like you can't get rid of all the other parts. You can't get rid of the journey. And I realized that no matter what I was doing, I was still on this journey. And now in a little town that I live in on the other side of here, West Cape May, New Jersey. I'm an elected official. I'm a commissioner. And I kind of put my hand on my head and go, what a long, strange trip this has been, to take the words of someone very famous from Marin County. I still believe that I am on a journey, not necessarily to a physical place, but a sacred space. I believe this land where we are right now, this Point Reyes, is where the spirit began speaking to me. And is why I'm on this journey, and it's why I've come back. I always come back because this is where it all began for me.
That was John Francis, the Planet Walker, at the Geography of Hope Conference in Point Reyes, California. And a big thank you to the wonderful group of people who made it all happen. Plus, a shout-out to our sound designer, Joe Hartke, who managed to make Footsteps, one of the oldest sonic cliches in public radio, sound like music, as they are. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks to the rest of our production team, Angelo Bautista, Shannon Henry Kleiber, Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, and Steve Paulson. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Wherever you walk today, be well, and thanks for listening.